3, 2, 1.
Boop. Shoop.
Welcome to the Pocket, episode 3, with a special guest, Mr. Michael Allenby.
Yes.
Welcome
in the pocket now.
You
I've
are
always wanted to be in the pocket. Been a drummer my whole life, but never was in the pocket.
Well, I did not know that about you.
And I'm a drummer?
Yes. Dude.
Man's Search for Pocket by Michael Allenby.
It's a long ass search.
That's awesome. So Michael is an old friend of the band from Charlottesville, which is where you're at right now. Technically, Earlysville, I do believe. He is the founder of the Festy Experience, which is an upcoming venue experience that everything is going to play. It's been connected through a lot of friends over the years, and we're going to kind of dive in on his history and our connections and stuff like that. But before we get into that, Michael, how are you being a brand new father?
I'm great now. Yeah. Before I was a father, I was much less focused in life, much, you know, things pulling me in all directions. But yeah, that's it's incredible. Wow. It's sort of like my crude analogy is like when you get some electronics or something that's got like that little like film over the top of it and you don't take it off right away. And then later on you realize it's on there and you're like, "Woo, look at that. That's nice." Yeah. It's just like the world before is like, it's a little hazy, a little weird. And now I'm just like, oh, whoa. Like, hey, that's some sci-fi shit. straight up. We are the aliens. Like,
yeah.
Picture of an alien, a newborn baby, identical.
Yeah.
Gigantic, malformed head, little gray, gangly body. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
This isn't that confusing anymore. We're obviously the aliens. And then it just goes, ah! And then we're like, all right, game on. Not game on like a deer where they like run away and they're off to the. It's like, game on.
Right.
Tell me. Yeah. What's totally.
Up? Like, totally.
What's up? And Craig and I were talking about this a little earlier before you jumped on the other call, and it was just like, yeah. And then so that's where I am. Like right now, I'm just like my like tools of self awareness and breathing and all kinds of stuff that I didn't have in my 20s. I didn't have in my 30s. Like just to have that at all right now, and to know that that's what I'm bringing. I'm not bringing some strategy or. Needing to tell them what's going on in the world. I don't like that's not like that perspective of father of like I need to instruct and be like the thing is I need to do is just like bring the vibe
totally and just, that's and that's what
and you can't fake it with these little
no
little,
that's
these
the
little
thing.
Nodes super sensitive nodes are just like
totally
bad vibes okay
yeah. that's what they're bringing. They're bringing that lesson, you know, they're like children are, you know, we create them, but really we, you know, we co-create them with the universe and they come from the universe and they're just like, oh, you know, and it's just like, I love holding newborns because it's just like, it's that, you know, like that little lump of like human is just like totally that, you know, like whatever that is. And so, yeah, the lesson is vibrationally, like, can you be there with that? And it's just, it's amazing. And it's great that's like step one, you know, cause it's like, all right, start with the basics. And then like all the advice and the, you know, the parenting and all that stuff that
strategy
can come later, but
like
start with the basics, start with that, yeah. Like that connection of love and, you know, whatever you call that ohm is awesome. And like you said, I remember when my firstborn Lily was born and I walked out of the hospital in Culpeper that morning. And it was just a completely different world. Like the world suddenly had this different context to it where it was just like, oh, this is the world in which my child lives. And like, I turned on the radio and I was like, oh my, like that, just all of it was like completely different. And it's just amazing how that journey works.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, when so Vera was born by C-section, so I was like the first, like, hands-on, and I remembered, like, you know, people before she was born, like, hey, are you going to cut the umbilical cord? And I was like, yeah, I didn't set out to have that experience. I wasn't like on my list of like, can't wait to do that. Right. Just don't need to hold the hose. Right. Don't need to cut it. Don't need a thing. And she cuts. So the doctor picks her up and she's purple, like a little alien. And I'm just like, oh, look, ET phone home. Oh shit. You just turned into a human. Hey Vera, how are you doing, buddy? Like, by the time she got to the pan, right? And then they're like, hey, do you want to cut the umbilical cord? And I was like, well, hell yeah. Like, why would I not want to do that? Like, why would I not want to have that experience? Or like, hey, do you want to, like, you know, give her first bath? And like, hey, she just, you know, dropped a deuce. Like, do you want to take care of that? And you're like, bring it. Like, let me wipe ET down here. And like, it's just amazing. Yeah, that change. You're just like, nah, I don't know about that. And then you're like, I don't know anything else.
Yeah. Right?
Like Alpha Space comes out
like that. This is
yeah,
like that.
Steven, well, how are you, buddy? Like, I, you know, we have a new friend on here, but I didn't want to ignore you, even though I've known you for a long time. So
hey, I'm here. Week? I'm good. I just got vaccine dose number 2 this morning. So it's funny because it's like my body's just kind of like on alert. Like, I'm like, do I feel okay? And so like, it's just like this weird, like kind of like when we took 5 here in between the two little, the Festy podcast and this podcast, I, like got up and got some water and kind of just walked around and I was just like, well, I don't know. I'm not really quite sure, but I'm stoked. I really like the idea that, especially with Festy coming up, especially with like some other things I'm doing this summer that I feel like that I'm doing the, you know, like what I can do to like keep myself safe and help, you know, keep the community on the right track and all that stuff. So that feels good. And it's been a really good week. The other thing I feel really good about is Light the Music is launching the Green Room, which is a place, right? Plug. The Green Room is a place where these creators that we've been working with, these student creators who are discovering, you know, digital audio music creation and collaboration and being in a virtual band together, like this is going to be the place where they can hang out and collaborate with each other and share stuff. And we'll have like cohort based courses inside of that and all that. So we're really like moving forward towards that. We've got some awesome people working with us on that. So it's been a really, really awesome week. So stoked.
Cool.
Fantastic.
How are you doing, Craig?
Dude, I'm pretty good. It's been a full week. You know, it's been a full week. Like I wake up in the morning and I want to have a good day with my kid and make cool things here on the Outer Banks and hang out with you guys. And been playing a lot of guitar and singing a lot to get ready for this Festy gig, you know, because I'm really stoked about it. Remind me, I want to tell you the essence of the problem story from my angle, Michael, that Steve was talking about, the emotional part of it all. I had the same emotions, but on an added layer. But it's been a great week. There's a lot going on. I mean, almost like too much to like get into an intro, but I feel really buoyant right now and joyful. So stoked to be here. And that would bring us to our next part of the podcast, Michael, which I think that our audience, tell us about your background, man. Because as the founder of the Festy and how we got here, tell us a little bit about like what's going on, because I've known you through Randy Reed, who is the manager and longtime collaborator conceptually for everything and still a real close brother of ours. But yeah, fill us in, man.
Yeah. Randy officiated in my wedding.
Oh,
so that's to throw in a little
shout out, Randy Reed plug.
But man, yeah. So I'm mostly a Virginian, most of my life in Virginia. Grew up in Williamsburg, and older brother, younger sister. Older brother just heavily influenced me in music, you know, kind of pulled me out of listening to hair metal bands, Poison and White Lion. And I was in that cult, you know, I was in the MTV cult. And he paid me to listen to the Hoodoo Gurus and REM. And
he paid you?
He would pay me. he would give me $1 to listen to a song 6 times.
Wow.
And inevitably I just keep listening to the album. Just, I would get distracted and just, so I got into the Hoodoo Gurus and really into Chronic Town and Murmur and, and he just totally shifted, you know, my headspace about where I was going to, you know, discover music and appreciation for music. And then, so he went to JMU. He went to JMU and I talked to him every single day on the phone during his first semester. And he emailed me he mailed me 2 CDs. He emailed me Johnny's Heritage and Everything Play. And he's like, man, I'm at JMU. I'm checking out the scene. These are the bands. This is what's going on. So yeah, I was in, you know, 10th grade or something, you know, rip and play. So yeah, that's how I first got touched by everything.
So just like, we'll keep going with your story of like, there are many more chapters, but like, so you put on this album that we made and our experience of it, of course, was like, you know, especially listening back to it now, where like how young we were, you know, like how, like, there's some interesting things on that album, but like, so you put in this CD and like, what happened next?
Nate Brown.
Yeah, right.
That's what I heard. I mean, that's what I heard.
Yeah.
I mean, no I doubt. Heard. And, you know, I was a drummer, but you just heard this ridiculous stuff going on, you know, by apparently some college kid. And it was interesting. There was a student at William & Mary. I think her name was Sally. Red hair, curly red hair. But she knew Nate, and I was like, oh my God, she knows someone in this band. And it was just this thing where I just felt like there was this, you know, my brother introduced me to it. So I was connected to it, but it resonated with me. I mean, certainly the sort of Virginia sound, the sort of party, you know, rock, I don't, you know, I call it the Virginia sound. I'm not sure where, but it's just that sort of thing that was happening. And I was in high school and very influential, absorbing a lot at that time, going to a lot of shows, you know, getting these influences. But I mean, I remember SLWB and I remember like laughing and it was fun and it was, you know, could pick up an acoustic guitar and ding, 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 like you could kind of, it was approachable, but you know, I remember the drums just being like, this guy's a, and I didn't know the term monster at the time. I wasn't even that into it, but I remember that was like the thing that I remember most in that first record, you know.
Still a monster.
Nate Brown. Jeez Louise. Still, like, I mean, force of nature, you know, and of all the drummers, I've through like the studio stuff that I've done and all the bands we've played with, worked with a lot of different drummers and Nate's pocket, like it's the rock of Gibraltar. Like he's always like in the pocket and like, it's funny, the cover band that Nate and I played in with Andy Waldeck, E3, we played like, you know, 50 shows a year and like just hours and hours of music over, you know, more than a decade. So like so much time playing. And every, like, it would happen like once a year where like Nate would drop a beat and Andy and I would both look back and be like, oh, he did it. He dropped a beat. And like, that's how often that happens. It's amazing. And then the other thing on top of that is like, so he has that, whatever that is, you know, like the pocket, like whatever that is. But then on top of that, he, when we were on the road, dude always had his sticks in his hand, like always. And like either a drum pad or the back of the seat or whatever. And he's always just always. And so like the amount of work that he put in on top of that, like innate talent is just insane. So Nate Brown.
Back to you, Michael. So we're, you're at JMU. You got to early play stuff. Then what?
Well, my brother's at JMU. I'm still in high school, but, I went to college in Connecticut, joined the, I got an engineering degree, but really I joined the activity board and, you know, that was really my education, was planning concerts, you know, booking, you know, my sophomore year, I booked, you know, Billy Joel solo, Dave and Tim on the first Dave and Tim tour. I did a big spring concert with the Connells and the Soul Coughing and the Violent Femmes and Biggie Smalls.
Dude,
you know,
did you go?
So that was just, my college was, you know, University of Connecticut Engineering, but my education was like, you know, they're going to give this 19-year-old kid the ability to just put on shows with not a lot of repercussions, you know, related to it. You know, someone, advisors and stuff behind the curtains, like solving the problems. But, you know, I'm hanging out with, you know, introducing the Piano Man, or, you know, hanging out backstage with Dave Matthews and, you know, Michael McDonald as tour manager at that time. And, you know, just experiences that were just going to be like, just, this is, and I remember I did, right after Happy Gilmore came out, I booked Adam Sandler my sophomore year, and, you know, 2,500 cap theater. And he, man, he just shows up in a sedan visiting his mom in Connecticut, decided to add a show, and things sells out, and he just walks up and just like, first thing, starstruck, first thing ever hits me is just this, you know, guy walks in, but it was this, two things about that show, Adam Sandler live. First of all, like, he walks out on stage and the entire audience just stands up and goes crazy. And I just lose it. I'm just like convulsing and crying. Cause I'm like, can't believe this whole thing. Like, this guy walks out on stage and I'm like, I was part of making that guy get here. And then everyone just goes like, and I just lost it. And then at, that was the beginning of the set, beginning of the show, you know, just big life-changing, emotional, right place, knowing it, so psyched. And then at the end of the show, obviously everyone's going crazy, probably plays Red Hooded Sweatshirt or something. And he like walks off stage and everyone's going crazy. Everyone's going nuts. And like, his tour manager looks at me, it looks at Adam. He's like, hey man, you want to do an encore? He's like, what material do I have? He like, his tour manager like spits off like three skits that he hasn't done yet. And the guy looks at me, he's like, hey, can we do an encore? I was like, yeah, absolutely. And I like get, and just, I was like, I didn't know how to communicate to everyone not to put on the house lights. I was like, I didn't have that flow yet. I didn't have that command of the room. And all of a sudden, like, I'm standing over that, I'm Sandler, and he's like getting ready to walk on stage and the house lights come on. Everyone gets in their seats and starts turning away. He's like, oh, fuck it. And I was just like this thing, it was perfect. And so it was, man, just, the lessons learned that period of time, college in Connecticut. And I think everything came and played at a place called Husky Blues in Storrs, Connecticut during that time when I was in school. And I came out and saw everything. This is like a comedy club bar.
Perfect.
And I got the members of everything to sign my copy of Play.
Nice.
Husky Blues, like, that's one of the ones that's sort of in the back recesses of a group of
You would like, erase that thing by noon the next day, I promise.
I have zero recollection.
I barely did. I didn't think, I was just kind of letting my, but I was like, oh, when was, I was like, when did I get that thing signed? I was like, oh, right.
Yeah.
So I don't know physical what era that was. I'm going to rewind. I got to rewind real quick.
Yeah, rewind, please.
Rewind back, just because the first time I got to see everything was back at Lake Metoka with DMB.
Yeah.
You know, another pivotal, you know, that experience, that's like, that informed a lot of the Festi experience probably back then, you know, that bucolic setting, you know, vibey, just everyone chilling. I'd been to the, you know, not the Bayou, but the, you know, Boathouse, and I'd been to like show, but I hadn't really been to something that has that sort of open grass sort of feel.
That was,
That was, you know, so back in high school, that was,
That was kind of like a peak scenario for Virginia, right? Because that was like Steve Lillywhite was at that show. I remembered. And I remembered like being by the keg with him and being like, this guy produced all these U2 records. And Dave was like really just about to explode. You could just feel it. And it just felt like the scene because Gibb was on that show too.
Right, and I was going to ask.
That was actually a friend of ours from JMU who was getting his MBA at William & Mary, Greg Sparrow. And he got in touch, was like, hey, I'm doing my my thesis for my MBA. I want to do this concert. And he's kind of like, you know, are you sure, bro? Like, you know, because like we would drink a lot with him. And I was be like, oh, we drank a lot, but like, doesn't mean you should be putting on a concert. And that thing was so amazing. And what's crazy about that is that like we were playing in like the summer of 2000, or was it 2001 when we did the Pacific tour, Steve? Do you remember? I think it was 2001,
I believe.
Okay. Yeah. And we were doing this USO tour all across the Pacific. And we were playing a show in Chuuk, Micronesia, Truk, which is 4 degrees off the equator in the middle of the Pacific. It's like Chuuk, Palau, Yap. And it's like, dude, you're in the middle of nowhere. And we were playing for all these local Chuukis and some like Air Force people that were there and some bivouacked Marine aviators who were stoked to be seeing like music in the middle of like the Pacific. And there was some Peace Corps people who came over from Palau, which was like a 2-hour flight to just even get to another island. And we were at this luau that the governor of Chuuk threw us because we did a public service announcement for him during the show, which was stay in school, don't take drugs and don't dynamite fish in the lagoon, which is like a 40-mile diameter, like, you know, protected waterway. And at this luau, there were these Peace Corps people. And there was this girl who came up and was just like, oh my God, I can't believe that you guys are playing here. I was at Lake Metoka. I was I'm like, fantastic. Welcome to Chuuk. Thanks for flying over here from Palau.
Yeah, that was a pretty, it was an infamous show. It really was. And just in that whole like connection of us, yeah. You know, and like coming back together, it's just like, of course I was at that show. You know, that was one of those shows. And it was everyone who was really tuned into the scene that was happening at that time. And I was, you know, still in high school and was young, but you know, but
there was a thing that we did that wasn't like you talk about the Virginia scene. I don't remember seeing it a lot of other places, but we would bring like when we did Soulfish, we would bring people on stage and I believe that show there's like, I mean, first of all, there's an ungodly number of people period on stage, but it's like, there's Dave Matthews, there's Gib Droll. There's like, I mean, it's just amazing who's on that stage at that moment making music together. It's just sick. Yeah. So that was just, that show was epic for a lot of reasons. I mean, it was a really awesome show, but yeah, that moment of just like everything kind of becoming this like 20 something person band with like the Virginia scene was amazing.
Yeah. Pivotal. And then I went to college and then immediately after college, got back to Virginia, came back down to, I actually lived in DC, started a band with a bunch of guys that I went to high school with, including my brother. Was in a band with my brother for 3 years in DC, working as a bar back. You know, I got a job with my engineering degree and I could maybe 5 months into it, I was like, there's just, this is not the way I'm going to spend my time. So I got a job at Record Exchange and I was a bar back at a club called The Garage and played in a band called Crenshaw and played, you know, did the same thing that you guys, you know, was doing, you know, went after that same be in an original rock band and trying to frame, you know, record, you go for record deals or you do all of that. And during that time, I befriended a guy who ended up managing Crenshaw right at the end. That guy's name was John Bradner. And John Bradner had a connection to everything as well. He had some Sperryville time and some Snake Doctors time. And so, yeah, there was like another sort of wave of everything in my life. I actually moved to Charlottesville then. I got my first, you know, job in the music business was actually the first employee of Sam Hill Entertainment. Hank Walls and I had actually gone to high school together. He was the same year as my brother. So that was, he brought me down to Charlottesville, and at the same time, Bradner moved to Charlottesville, and we all lived in a house together. So I got, you know, my first year in Charlottesville was this, had this other wave of, you know, moving to a new town, getting into the, back into the music space, starting to do some booking and living and working, you know, with Bradner on some projects. So it was another sort of crossover into the whole, everything space. Actually, the woman who bought that house that we lived in was also from Sperryville. And also, I'm blanking on her name. She lives over on Douglas Avenue in Charlottesville. She's like an herb. She grows herbs. Oh, and
Kathleen.
Kathleen, yes. Kathleen bought the house that Bradner and I lived in.
Wow. Such spreads.
Yes. Such spreads. You know, so John Bradner, I remember when he was like 27 or so, and I remember he being like, guys, I'm out of the music business. I'm going to go join the Navy. And it was just like, later in life to do that. So John Bradner has been stationed in Norfolk, and John Bradner, my brother, was a 30-year career Navy officer, and John Bradner worked for my brother in the Navy. So John Bradner is the only person on planet Earth that has worked for both of the Honeycutt brothers. And it's funny. I was driving with my brother, and he was still active. He was a captain. And I remember being like, he was like, hey, let's call Bradner, you know? And so we call, and it's like, you know, hello, you know, Lieutenant Bradner. And my brother's like, you know, hey, it's George. And he's like, oh, hello, sir. How are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm doing pretty good, man. I got someone here for you. And I'm like, Bradner. And he's like, oh my God. So it was, what threads. And Kathleen's a dear old friend of ours. I mean, she's like legit as a nationally known herbalist, man. She's super potent as well, you know, and she's got strong connections with Rising Appalachia that's coming to play a gig too. So,
oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah. Look at us weaving magic.
Kathleen kept my son out of the surgery where you get the tubes in your ears. So,
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Cool. Yeah. She's great. Whenever I'm over in that neighborhood, I tend to see her, and she's always very friendly. And so, yeah, so that was right around 2000, 2001, you know, moving to Charlottesville and living with Bradner and booking cover bands at fraternities, for Sam Hill. And that sort of got me into the space. So that's, from when I was at Sam Hill, Hank, we did a quick little side project called Sam Hill Presents, and we promoted one show. It was Gillian Welch at, Charlottesville High School.
Wow.
Sold out 1200 tickets, you know, like batting 1,000, you know, yeah. Promoted one show. It definitely showed me that I wanted to probably be a promoter. It was kind of had that sort of that energy, it was sort of like I remember I couldn't even watch that show. I just sat in the lobby the whole time at Charlottesville High School and just sat on a table. It was like, I couldn't, it was like the Adam Sandler thing again. I was like, I couldn't even go in there. It was so awesome. You know, it's like, and Gillian was like one of my favorite things at the time. I just like couldn't go in the room. And it really proved to me that I wanted to get into this business deeper. I didn't want to be a middleman, you know, which is what I was doing at Sam Hill. You know, the middle, you're not the band, you're not in that business, and you're not the show, you're not in that business, you're in the middle. I was like, I don't want to be an agent. I don't want to be a middleman. Either, you know, at that time was, you know, I want to produce shows. Hank didn't want to. He very distinctly did not want to go into that space. He liked being the middleman.
His model was always to be the agency, to be the booking the shows, but also to do more, focus more on like events and cover bands and that stuff, right? Was that always?
No, that evolved. At the beginning, he was the I don't represent any band's agent. So I don't, you know, where the East Coast Entertainment, some of those other agencies, they would have those in-house exclusive bands.
Right.
And his original line was like, hey, my commission's a little cheaper and I can get you anyone you want. I'm not going to sell you something you don't want. So
right. Nice.
This was early on. This was the very, very beginning. And he was, you know, Sam Hill's evolved quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit since those days.
Yeah.
But he just wasn't comfortable being in the actual risk game concert promotion business.
Yeah, yeah.
Even after a great successful show.
Yeah.
It just was clear it wasn't the space that he wanted to be in.
We signed exclusive with them. So they were, you know, like the decade that E3 played shows, they were our booking agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I've loved Hank especially, but the whole team at Sam Hill, like they do a really good job. We signed with them for a reason. Like they were a little bit more innovative and we're looking at, you know, just ways to kind of push into the technology and just better ways to do all of that stuff. And they were a great, just awesome partner. They pushed us, we pushed them. Like it was really good. So like super shout out to them.
Totally. That's what it, I mean, that whole space just needs tight information. And Hank just jumped right into that database point of view of just like, if you just get all the boxes checked, there's no problem. Yep. And if you can make it no problem for a bride, then you're a magician.
Yep. Totally. Like, huge.
So tell us, like, so you evolved into a little red light management action and then into the artist farm. So take us through that a little bit, because I think we're getting
That's right when it happened. What I remember when I was sitting in the lobby sitting on that table nervous as hell, is I saw Chris Tetzeli leave the show halfway through and get in his car. And about 6 months later I worked for Tets.
Oh sweet.
So yeah, I left that. I just left a big impression on the community. I think a lot of people were calling Red Light for tickets, assuming it was a Red Light show because there was no other promoter in town. And it just got, I was able to get the attention of sort of the music industry zeitgeist at the time. And at the same time, I had a friend, Chris Sampson, who was working there as a day-to-day manager. And he, he lived on the same street in, you know, downtown Charlottesville. And he took me up to DC to check out a band he was managing. On the way up, he told me what band management was. And I was like, holy shit, that's what I should be doing. I was like, I didn't really know what that, it was a thing, you know, but he told me, I was like, get me into that shit. So, I don't know, right around that time, I called Corin out of the blue and was just like, I was kind of promoting shows and Hank didn't want to back and support. I kind of felt like loose. And I just kind of felt like I should be part of something and doing something. And not just, I was like, I don't really know this town that well. I'm not. So I just cold called Corin. I was like, hey, I'm doing a bunch of shit. I want to do a bunch of shit. I was, you know, there's a place up in the corner called the Satellite Ballroom that I was starting to buy for. And I was just like, and Corin's like, what do you want to do? I was like, I was interviewing for the head of marketing for Music Today and all these random things. But then all of a sudden, you know, Chris Tetzeli started signing a bunch of bands and needed a manager. And I just, you know, he was like, did you do that Gillian Welch show? I was like, yeah. He's like, and like a couple of weeks later, like that was my card. I'd done that. I'd pulled off a proof of concept. So yeah, man, Red Light, this was Red Light, you know, basically like the Harvard Business School of the music industry. I mean, especially during that era.
Yeah, totally.
You know, because it was, you know, still out at Seven Oaks at Corin's house, you know, still had like, there were no other offices. It was all out of there. And it was, you know, it was just a incredible time, exciting time, sitting in one room with, you know, Randy Reed, Adam Foley, Chris Tetzeli, Chris Sampson. Just the discussions going on in that space, just like sitting there, like ATO happening and growing and decisions being made around that. And I'm just like, it's all right in my ear. Like, I'm just like sitting and then, you know, growing to an office downtown, you know, just all, and then the whole thing just went, and to be a participant in that is just something, it's just a priceless experience as far as just, especially because Corin was just an intense innovator at the beginning. You know, just Music Today and ATO and the whole Dave Matthews, I'm going to own our whole ecosystem. And just like, just that whole thing to be present for it. And part of its next, that thing where like Bruce Flohr came in and now it was really getting into the, like, not just the indie roots jam scene, but now getting over into the actual, you know, music industry, you know, at large, you know, being a player. So I was a day-to-day manager for North Mississippi All-Stars and the John Butler Trio and fucking Los Lobos. And
dude, you were doing Los Lobos?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I was the guy who had to get the five members of Los Lobos to agree.
Wow.
That was my job. They had to agree on every single show had to be approved by all members.
Yeah.
Before you could confirm it. And that was essentially my role, is to go get these like salty old friends who, like, you know, are all like always poking at each other and always like, it's just, I need to get them all to say yes. We need this tour. We need to lock this tour in. But yeah, I mean, incredible experiences, really incredible experiences.
So Los Lobos album Kiko,
mm-hmm.
that album is so just innovative, so amazing, so beautiful. And it always, it blew my mind because like, I knew of Los Lobos like sort of before that and sort of, you know, like definitely an interesting band, super talented, something really like unique to say, like where they were coming from. But then Kiko for me was just like, what? So it's interesting hearing about like sort of their process. And this was one of Justin Lauder is a lawyer here, also a musician here in Richmond. And mm-hmm. he sent us this list of questions. He's like, I love the podcast you guys are doing. Here's some questions. And one of the questions was like the songwriting process. So this is a multi-tiered question. It goes back to like sort of build, test, learn, and maybe some stuff that you learned even as an engineer of sort of that process of how you get from like an idea to a something, you know? And like so working with Los Lobos, whether it was for Kiko or for something else, like that leap into the unknown, you know, which is like creating something or putting on another, you know, show or doing whatever those things are, like describe that process both for you as like, because I know you've got like the designer chops too of like really like a lot of it's about saying no to stuff and but that process is like juicy. So talk about that like process if Los Lobos is a good like example of like how to go through that, like what are things that you learned as you did that stuff?
Wow, what an incredible framing. I mean, I could describe, I mean, there was one record, one Los Lobos record that I was sort of involved in during mm-hmm. the period of time that I was working with them. I mean, but there's just so much to talk about Los Lobos as a band. Can you reframe your question in a different way? I just want to make sure.
Mind blowing, Steve, the framing of the question was its own thing.
yeah.
It was like a little piece of word art.
Yeah. So I'm just fascinated with the process, like the creative process to get from like an idea into something that works. Right.
Yeah.
So with Los Lobos, that's a really interesting, like sort of Petri dish. And so you're working with these guys that are sort of like, you know, have a bunch of different sort of agendas or sort of criteria. And then like, so to make this album, which album was it?
It's called The Town and the City.
Okay.
Which they have a lot of different types of albums, but I was involved in the process, you know, working with them during that time, but it's it's called The Town.
So the question, like, just to boil it down, like, what did you learn about like, you know, the creative process and sort of like, you know, the build, test, learn of it all? Like, what did you learn in working with them?
Yeah. I learned a lot and almost, I want to talk about Los Lobos, and I think I'll probably answer your question in doing this, just because I think they are such an interesting example of a band and how there's so many different strategies and elements that makes up a band's career. And these guys are just, there's such an interesting career there.
Yeah.
And it's because it's this like East LA rock band.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what they are. They're this really rocking, tight, deep rock band from East Los Angeles, you know? And, you know, you get this flavor of this Brooklyn Jew, Steve Berlin, who gets thrown in there because he was, he was in a punk band called the Blasters, I think, and they crossed paths and he kind of split over into Lobo. So the chemistry of that band is just so really, you know, because volatile was the word that came to head. I didn't want to say that word, but because there's like, you have like this like family of some of the original characters and the sort of, you know, Eastern Los Angeles culture, which is, you know, just a space that I was personally just wasn't that deeply aware of. And, you know, they're So they're a rock band from LA called The Wolves. That's one framing, you know?
Right.
Or during some time in their career, and this is earlier on, you enter this Hollywood Records movie crossover La Bamba opportunity.
Yeah.
Opportunity, big opportunity. And David Hidalgo sings La Bamba. It's a classic tune. They do it. And of course, the movie goes giant. And this band, who is a rock band from LA called The Wolves, you know, is one way to frame it. If you think about it as a white person, that just helps frame of like, they're not right. called Los Lobos from really their point of view.
Right.
From their point of view, they're called The Wolves, you know, because that's just, but in America at that time and that framing of that song, they became La Bamba and they became Los Lobos with La Bamba.
Yeah.
And they're really the, and the attention and the marketing that powered their career enforced and codified this idea that they are the La Bamba Los Lobos.
Yeah.
Not the rock band, The Wolves. Los Lobos. You know?
Yeah, man.
And I just think that there's just, so working with them and everything they do, to them, they're Los Lobos, The Wolves. They're the East LA rock band. And then at the end of every show, they have to play La Bamba. And that's my take on it. I don't know that I ever really heard them even talk, but it was like, I felt like there was this, always this real sort of struggle of capitalizing on this amazing exposure or this exposure opportunity that happened through the music and the movie industry and, you know, this sort of unlikely sound, huge soundtrack, you know, the La Bamba soundtrack, which I own, you know, I had when I was, you know, a kid and my parents listened to, it was a phenomenon, but so, you know, those records are where you can really find that band who's a band, who's a rock band from East LA, who's creative and finding their thing. And yeah, that's where they have some incredible records, you know, and, you know, Colossal Head is one of my favorite. Just weird and awesome and dirty and just like Hidalgo ripping on Mossy Moss. And it's just like, just there's so many people that don't have that framing and never really got to learn that band. And you really had to be like a niche hardcore fan and catch them in the club on the right thing, you know, and it was just, so it was a, you know, sort of a management perspective. I mean, in the town, the city. So there's essentially David Hidalgo and Louis Perez songwriting team, you know, words and music, Louis doing most of the writing, David doing the music. And that's a lot of the, you know, the more artistic, creative influence, indie influences that you hear that come in that creative piece. Caesar's on the other end of the spectrum and he'll write a nice banger, you know, with a little Spanish flair. And, you know, and then Steve Berlin's a producer. He produces records and he comes very much from the technical side of stuff. So, you know, a lot of the records I think have that influence. You're getting that Hidalgo Perez chemistry songwriting team type thing, which has its own, I'm blanking on the name of their side project right now. They have a side project that really leans into that side of it. You know, they have records, et cetera. I'm just having a brain fart right now on what that's called.
Word.
Their other project.
So you graduate from Red Light to the music.
That's a good farm, word for it.
For the Artist Farm. Music Farm's a club in Charleston. The Artist Farm was the cutting edge, innovative artist management company.
The Music Farm was one of the things we thought to call it. And of course that was already taken. Yeah. So Tets went out to Colorado, started Red Light Denver. And myself and another day-to-day manager, Ben Coe, split off from Red Light. And just, you know, we had just come from the world of artist management. I mean, world-class artist management as far as what was happening in that time and the growth of Red Light and, you know, big careers growing. And, and you know, we, you know, continued to want to serve artists and wanted to do what we could in that space. And, you know, imagined that we were going to become artist managers, but sort of quickly right after being there, kind of after the smoke cleared of being out of Red Light, we were like, what does a manager do exactly? Like, I'd just been doing it, I think, right. Or dated, like, but it was just like, it was just, it was a weird value proposition to me at that time, because I wasn't really sure what was happening at Red Light. And when we were there, it was all moving and growing so quickly. And we were really interested in sort of, as day-to-day managers, sort of sharing systems and information and like creating ways, because we were always just kind of slogged in our email, like, there's a show popping up or something has to get put out. I was like, can't we, like, the internet was happening, Facebook, you know, it was just like, there's like systems and stuff we could be creating. And Ben and I put a fair amount of energy into seeing if that could happen inside of Red Light. And it was just clear that growth was happening, and organizing it and getting it dialed in was not on the agenda at that time. So that's what really inspired the Artist Farm, which was, what if we took all of the stuff that we were doing as day-to-day managers and just organized it into a set of services and just offered that to artists, rather than, hey kid, you need a manager, you're going to pay 20% and you're going to get everything, you know, included in that, you know, just taking care of everything and wiping your butt, you know, like, what if we're like, we don't want to wipe butts, not on the menu, but we could help you create a good website. We could market your tour dates. We could do that for $100 a tour date. You know, we could do it, like, break it down to a set of like, what are you actually doing, manager person? And can we come up with some value proposition that's fair to compensate you for that? So that was the idea of the Artist Farm. And we literally created a menu of services and, had, you know, maybe 10 or dozen clients starting out, basically artists who were self-managed, or their manager didn't need a day-to-day manager. And we were like a good option for like a day-to-day manager, or like, I think it was a sound concept, you know, scalable concept, could have turned into software or something, or that was sort of the vision. And a couple things happened. One of those bands that we were working with was the infamous String Dusters. We're sort of doing services for them. And at the same time, Ben Coe had his first child, and the business we had created was not going to sustain a child. So kind of I slipped back into artist management right at that point, and Artist Farm went from being this, you know, services thing, which was really Ben's systematic mind of really creating those things and executing them, and my being able to tell the story of the systems and, you know, it's integrating with the artist, communicating with the artist. And really the best thing that I liked and thought was the most productive thing that we did with the artist as part of our services, part of doing services with us, is once a week we would get on the phone with you and do a session like this. And that was always the most, it was like a coaching session. They really liked it. And from there, I really just, you know, grew a great appreciation for the infamous String Dusters. And when the system of the Artist Farm kind of went away, it kind of graduated from me going back into artist management now independently through the Artist Farm. And to fast forward a bit within that is, you know, my approach. Well, first of all, my approach in artist management was, I'd seen lots of different approaches to artist management when I was at Red Light, but there is definitely one approach that is the approach that is, the idea is the artist needs to be managed. Like, they are somehow not fully functional, and we need to craft, augment, supplement, suggest, bring in other people, bring in other stuff, you know, and that thing needs to be managed, you know, needs to wear different clothes, needs to be on a different schedule, needs to have a different idea of what this hook sounds like, whatever it is, they need to be somehow managed in some way. You know, and then the other approach would be that the artist is actually the only person who knows what's going on. That's why everyone goes into a room and stares at them and pays money to do it. So what they really need is, they need whatever they're doing to be brought to the surface. Hmm. They need a team put around it, and that team needs to be managed, you know?
So more like empowerment?
Sure. Yeah. Or, I mean, to me, the skill is, the management is coaching. It's not really managing. It's
right.
It's like helping that they're just may have trouble articulating exactly what it is that what they want to do fits into the zeitgeist of business.
Right.
But it's mostly that they often get stumped at getting out what they are trying to say. And then it's really a bunch of people that once they can really get it out and say it and believe it and not feel like they're defending it, or once that gets out, then yeah, just you create a plan around it. You know, getting the artist to articulate it is the hardest part, you know?
Well, I think, you know, from our experience, and we worked with one of the best. I mean, it's funny talking about that original Red Light team, you know, like Michael McDonald, the best road manager I've ever seen, maybe the best period, like just amazing how he just like made it all happen. And like when we opened up for Dave on that tour, like he was handling stuff for us. He was just like, yeah, like guest list names, just like all of that stuff, like taking care of us. And we were the opener, you know? So just amazing, amazing team at Red Light. And then Randy, like, you know, so we came up out of JMU with Randy Reed as our manager from the jump. Like as soon as we went full time on the road, he was our manager. And I think partly it's like sort of a testament to him, like how crazy we were. I mean, we lived into the band Everything name. We lived into that aesthetic. We were completely all over the map stylistically, what we wanted to do. We were like day to day, we were so like, you know, just like the ideas that we had and the things that we wanted to try. Like there's a wonderful fearlessness to that. There's a wonderful like experimental like awesomeness to it. And then there's this other part which is just like crazy making for like if you're trying to do like branding or you're trying to do like, you know, like any of the business stuff, you know. And I think Randy, like hats off to Randy for like, you know, being a fantastic manager. But I think we might be a case study of like how we really did need, you know, somebody that was like, okay, we're headed in this direction, right? Okay, cool. Here's what that means. Here's what we're doing. And like, I think without Randy, I can't even imagine what we would have been able to accomplish, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is still that, the je ne sais quoi to the manager relationship.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, there's only one qualification that the manager has to have, is that the band calls them the manager.
Right. Right.
Everything else is negotiable.
Yeah.
Everything else is as needed basis. But as soon as the band doesn't call them the manager, no longer the manager. Like, right. You know, and that's like that fact coupled with the artist farm concepts, you know, and the philosophical concept of who's leading this really, whose idea is it?
Right.
I mean, I've more recently gotten back into management actually. So it's, I've had to, you know, realizing that some of my own creative input as a manager, and I read a really exciting, it was an exciting book for me. It was about the Black Crowes, of Steve Gorman's book, the drummer for the Black Crowes writing. It's called Hard to Handle, the story of the Black Crowes.
Yeah.
And just hearing about Pete Angelus, that manager, and really the role he had in the Black Crowes. And it was just, it's still something that I haven't settled into exactly. And with the artist I work with now, I'm still like, how much do I want to bring my vision here of what I think they are, what I think they can be, and what I think is possible versus I think the purest sense is if you can really tap in and have the skill, you know, and the coaching skill to really ask the right questions of the artists so that they answer with that laser focus that came from them
versus
needing to be sold on them. And I think that, I mean, I'm not there yet in my skill set, but I think in the meantime, you end up compensating with some of your own stuff and needing to steer it. I'm sure, I mean, especially at that time, you guys were in still major label hot world and deal making and radio. And I mean, there was an opportunity. I mean, Los Lobos, that other analogy, it's like, well, what if La Bamba never happened?
Right.
Like what, maybe Los Lobos would never exist. It would have totally imploded right away. Or maybe, you know, I don't want to speculate. That's not the point, but you know, and yeah, Randy, you couldn't ask for, you know, a more gentle manager. I mean, like
grounded, you know, I think that was the thing that we needed, was like that groundedness. You know?
Yeah. So that's, he was, when Ben and I were leaving Red Light, you know, he and Adam took me and Ben to lunch and sat down, and we were just kind of brainstorming for a second. Like, sure you're leaving? You sure we shouldn't be like, doing something here together, just like before, just, and he's always been just totally kind. And then of course, I mean, my wife and I, who have, I think, grown more similar over the years that we've been together, but even when we were getting married, we're, you know, very different people, and trying to find one way that we would get married and one person, Randy Reed. It was like we couldn't probably think of any one other person that we know who we would trust to be there, that we would both, like, it would just suit kind of everything.
Right.
Not to mention the actual job that he did officiating, which was like Oscar winning, badass, writing, directing, and acting.
That's such a role. Like, the officiant is such a role. I can't believe
I asked him. I can't believe he said yes. And it's so cool. it's such a gift. Such,
yeah,
a gift.
It is. It's such,
especially
a blessing.
Like, it's just not going to take it lightly.
I mean, yeah, just totally.
What I'm feeling here, Michael, is that you are, we're in your evolutionary path where you are, coaxing some information out of the infamous string dusters, and it is leading to something called the Festy experience.
Yeah, exactly. That was my management style. I was like, okay, what do you guys want to do? And they were like, bluegrass festivals suck. I was like, what do you mean? Well, there's no hospitality, the production's horrible. These are like traditional bluegrass festivals. That was the space they were in at the time. They were in the traditional bluegrass world. So they were like, I was like, okay, let's make your own festival. Like, we can do that. It's like, yeah, sure. And their biggest market, they lived in Nashville at the time. Their biggest market was Colorado. So we started sort of thinking about that. And then a guy that I went to high school with, Justin Bilcheck, had started to look to do some shows and had found out that there's this place called Devil's Backbone that was being built. And that guy wanted to start like doing events there and have things there. And Justin called me because I had been managing a band called Old School Freight Train. And he called me for that band. They had just broken up. I just started managing officially the String Dusters. They had one hole in their calendar between Kentucky and Pennsylvania on a Saturday. And it happened to be this day that Justin was doing this thing called the Brew Ridge Trail Music Festival out of Devil's Backbone. Justin had just seen the String Dusters at Delfest, which is another festival that he worked for. And we got it done like on a phone call. And that got the String Dusters, me, Justin, Benko, and John Spagnolo all at the same time with Devil's Backbone standing on that property for an event. And we were like, wait a second. we don't have to go there. And at that time, a bunch of stuff happened. Three of the String Dusters moved to Charlottesville. And we started, you know, I basically started, you know, I feel my role in that was letting Justin do his thing, in learning how to build festivals and design festivals, which is what he was doing, and letting the String Dusters create an event that was going to be the best experience for them as artists from the artist point of view, and also for the fan and the fan experience. And that's a lot of those early ethics of just, you know, being a more boutique event, you know, really thinking about the lineup and trying to book booking career artists and not trying to get like the thing that's popping and flipping right now, and really just building around fans and careers and just keeping it really hospitality focused, you know? And I mean, that's where the term came out. It wasn't a festival. It was an experience. It was the Festy experience, you know, and that was from the very beginning, that was the idea, is that, you know, we're not trying to build some big massive thing. We're really the experience from the artist point of view, and the experience from the fans' point of view, which was, you know, where Justin was, you know, helpful in focusing. And then, yeah, it became this cool petri dish. You know, we just kind of rolled the dice and tried something, and then, you know, then you've got 13 partners in a business that's a once a year weather dependent
perfect
party. Well, it was interesting because for a few years it looked really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, we all grew in different ways, and we became different. And just as things played out, you know, I stopped managing the Dusters, and, you know, in that process, they parted ways with Festy. They were integrated into it. They were like the host band, but to me, there was still something in Festy that wasn't done yet. I mean, there's sort of a few year period of time where, like, the team, the band broke up, you know, you know, it's right. Like Justin and myself and the Dusters, we all went separate ways. And I was just the one who was like, I don't think Festy's done yet, just because we're not working together. I still think there's something in this name, in this brand, you know, that I'm not done with yet. And I think some of the other members thought it was done. They thought what we were doing was the thing, and we're just cool with that being the thing. To me, it was, you know, selfishly, or what I needed at that time, or why I was doing it, was because it was something that could be shaped. It was something that could evolve, and it was something that could have a feedback loop. And I really, you know, once I didn't have other partners in it, I really have changed it a lot over a few years, you know, and that is, I mean, if you're just trying to build a steady growth business, major brand and elemental changes aren't necessarily recommended. But that was really what I deep learning over a few years of me moving location, sharing property with Locke, and moving it into downtown Charlottesville, really, you know, trying to do things like drop the carbon footprint of an event. It's like, you actually want to drop, you want to make a green event. First of all, don't do one. You want to make a really green event. But if you don't send thousands of people driving out to a rural area and make a pop-up shanty town,
right,
you're just going to fill dumpsters with a bunch of crap, and you're going to, you know, have,
yep,
you know, a massive amount of, you know, greenhouse gas effect from thousands. I mean, that's like Radiohead did a study. It's like the stuff you do on site, the recycling programs on site, are not moving the needle. The carbon footprint is the transportation of the whole mm-hmm. thing being yeah. moved in and out of some rural location. So yeah, I mean, I was playing, always tweaking, always steel cut program, getting rid of single use plastic, you know, like I booked fewer and fewer bands every year. I watched every single year. I was like, I want the sets to be longer. Mm-hmm. You know, I want fewer stages. Like I evolved it like that way into simplifying, and COVID just allowed this total acceleration in the process of what I was extrapolating towards, which was minimalism.
Right.
You know, it's like, what is this? How can I get this vibe, but without this big, risky, crazy, wasteful thing? You know, that was always in the back of my head. That was motivating me to keep doing Festy every year, even if years it didn't make money or it wasn't, you know, it didn't seem like it was worth the effort. It was like, there's something here. There's some way to do it. And that's, you know, that sort of, you know, when COVID hit, I had this brand and I had this thing, and I just had this permission to do whatever we wanted with it. And I just went super extreme with that. It was like, what is the lightest feather thing? What is the essential elements here? And it's like one artist and just their favorite, just their hardcore fans, you know, and the setting, you don't need anything. If you put it at Lake Eden in Nashville, you put it at, you know, the Nature Reserve in Charleston, or you put it at Chisholm Vineyards in Hurleysville, it's like, you don't need anything else, really, you know, if you can set that up. So yeah, that was like, you know, Festy has just been this, you know, my wife calls it our firstborn. It's been this, you know, it's been this project that, you know, I don't think it's certainly not done yet, but I feel like I feel very excited that what Festy is now is, it's fulfilling the reasons that I have been doing it for over a decade. There are lots of different partners and lots of different reasons people were doing it. Devil's Backbone was doing it to sell beer. Totally sure. Cool. But there was lots of different reasons people were making that event happen. So yeah, it's personally fulfilling to me that I, you know, continue to work on it, but mostly that I feel like it's getting down into something that I think is scratching an itch of a, you know, of a need, and a something that I think that it could really add value. You know, I think in the last few years, a Roots Music Festival in the East Coast, I mean, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of them. I mean, I don't know where we were really adding value, you know, across the board of what was going on there.
So would you say the root concept, like the driving mission that you've kind of been like throwing different things at, but like the root concept is just this radical idea that a concert should be like really just focused on the experience for both the artists and the fans, like that's the, as opposed to, you know, like a big festival where the idea is to, you know, make money, sell beer, you know, like there are different driving factors. But like, it feels like when we first talked to you about Festy, and especially like, you know, what COVID did was sort of like burned off all of the BS, like in the disruption of it. It's like, okay, well then what's the core thing here? But is that, would it be fair to say that that's like the sort of the radical concept that Festi has like sort of at its root always sort of been like, okay, well, what's the optimal user experience here that, you know, I'm a fan. I care about the environment. I want to see this band that I love. Like, how can you maximize that experience for me? Like, is that and then for the band, obviously, as well, is that like sort of the ethos, the mission of Festi?
Yes. The word experience is something, it's very much part of our zeitgeist right now, but 11 years ago, it was a weird word.
Yeah. That's
the Festi experience. So funny, sounded like the Festi shanty rock. It's whereas like the Festi, like who's foos. It didn't, right now, like user experience UI, like that's a, right. That's, it's just like, that is very much part of something in the last 6, 7, 8 years, you know, the experience business, the whole, yeah. You know, the,
totally.
But it wasn't then. And that absolutely stuck out, you know, to for me. I mean, again, a lot of other people were part of the original, but for the reason that that was the thing is like, and to be a little less cynical on the way that you framed it, but it's like the other model is we need a lot of people. Because because we want to see really big artists,
right.
And we need the economics to work. Yeah. So the we're going to start with the premise of we need a shit ton of people.
Yep.
Yeah.
And now let's get a lineup that draws a shit ton of people.
You know?
Yep.
Like let's get, it's just like everything gets built around the idea that we need it to be big in order to work.
Right.
And we could get into the reasons of why the history of the music business and, you know, that the concert ticket has always been subsidized, starting with the record business. You know, there was tour support back in the day. It was never built to be economically sustainable. So we keep layering on all these costs, but without increasing the experience.
Right.
The amphitheater experience is still the same as it was in the 70s and 80s. You still are out in the suburbs, caught in traffic, sitting in a big parking lot. It's still the exact same thing. Nothing has improved in that experience. Like, all they do is put a more expensive VIP section up, which is basically just the same experience of the cheaper ticket before, but now we're just going to raise the ticket price. Didn't increase the experience for anyone.
Right.
So it's just, I think that, so yes, the answer is like, yes. Well, what if you just approach it from a different way? Not that we need it to be big, and big is better, and big is how we end up selling CDs, which is how concerts were invented in this. It's how festivals were invented in this country. Not the same way they were in Europe. They were invented to sell CDs. They were radio shows.
Yeah.
That's how you got to see big bands. They were called radio shows. They were subsidized by record labels. That's how it was invented here. And in that DNA is the idea that it has to be big. It has to be broadcast. So it's like a different DNA approach. What if you started with the artist and their one hardest core fan?
Right.
Well, that's probably not enough attendees for a good, how about their 10 hardest core fans? Or maybe 50, or let's start from there.
Yeah.
Don't let those other people in. I mean, they can get on a live stream, you know, but don't let them that close to the art. Don't immediately let. So it's just, so yeah, I think it's a great way to frame it. And I think it's very true to the initial brand and where it was at the beginning and what I was passionate about. It's like, if you start from there, it doesn't mean you couldn't eventually get big.
Yeah.
But you have to create, you know, it's almost like creating software. Like you have to create the little thing and it has to work and then you can scale it. You know, but if it never worked, and that's where I'd done a New England version of Festi before. The idea of doing a more boutique event in several places rather than creating one giant destination thing has always been part of it too. But before is like, I just took a normal festival and tried to do two of them. It was just like, that wasn't, you need to get it down to something that can actually scale and move, you know, two big inefficient things doesn't naturally just make it more efficient.
Totally.
You know, put them next to each other.
It's just to like sort of to illustrate the other model, when we were doing radio shows, you know, we're playing for thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people, and then, you know, the radio station is doing their thing, and we would finish playing, and then it was like, okay, off to the autograph tent, you know. And so then we're like, you know, signing autographs, and there's people that have been standing in line for hours to get an autograph.
An autograph.
And by the time they get up to us, they're like, who are you guys?
Yeah. Who are you guys? Yeah. Just sign this. And you're just like, it's like, you're like, It's amazing. Yeah, they'd be like, yeah,
in line for hours. So they weren't at the show. They weren't in front of the stage.
Yeah, they weren't seeing their band that they wanted to see, or you know, like I don't know what the like that user experience is. Just such a perfect example of like that's definitely not it. You know, like that's definitely not right. You know, and they came away from that with like this autograph from this band that they probably didn't even know, or like maybe they knew Hooch, but like,
yeah.
So what? You know, like it's just such an experience.
Dudes, exactly. Hey, we're coming up on about an hour here, and I want to be mindful of everybody's time. And I have a young, and I got to go grab in a second. But you know, Michael, like part of well, first of all, we're stoked to have you on the pocket. But you know, everything is getting back together officially as everything for the June 5th Festi experience at Chisholm Vineyards in your Charlottesville location. I know you've expanded the Festi to Asheville and Charleston. Do you guys have any like parting thoughts on something you want to mention about the show or any kind of things you want to cover before we get out of here?
I mean, just, it sounds like I'm repeating myself, but I think it was in our earlier conversation, not this one, but just so people know, I mean, that Festi is designed, so you can have sort of the most, connection and time with your favorite artist. So just, you know, anyone who's tuning into what's going on with everything right now. You know, it's obviously a very safe event. It's outdoors. The tickets are sold in these sort of VIP suite pods where you've got a QR code where the food, beverage, and merch just gets delivered to you, basically so you don't have to miss a song. You can hone in and focus. We've got amazing Blue Ridge Mountain views, you know, estate-grown wine right there on site. So it's you know, as you articulate there, Steve, it's an experience. And this is I think has the largest experience, certainly to environmental impact ratio of anything that I've ever designed. And we're here, and I'm not only like excited about it personally, just cause I like the way it looks and feels, but, the feedback that we're getting from fans has just been great, that they're just like, not only appreciative to see music, but they're like, I like going to clubs sometimes. Sometimes that's the vibe. I like going to a festival where it's more social and more, you know, discovery based. But for demographics and for, you know, certain audiences, especially, you know, coming on these times, I think some people just want to go listen, you know, they just want to go listen to some tunes and they want to actually hear what's going on. And I think that's the opportunity for people.
Love that. Awesome. Steve, you got anything you want to cover, brother?
I'm just so excited. And I'll say it again. Thank you so much for creating this opportunity for us to play a show, to make it really count for fans and make it safe and all that stuff, which is like sort of would have been the deal breaker otherwise, but like that opportunity to play music with people again. Thank you.
The parenting experience. Hello.
We'll wrap it up on the parenting father.
Look at that
experience.
Little baby. Who do we have here, Michael?
This is Libby.
Hey, Libby.
Hey, Libby.
Elizabeth Ann Allenby.
Oh, man.
Well, Steve, you're very welcome. And I'm stoked, as I was saying before, I think, you know, it takes the bands and the fans all saying yes. And right now we're stoked. We're going to have a party, man. It's going to be a great spot.
Woo!
Perfect.
Thanks for joining us on The Pocket. Steve, are you going to take us out, buddy? You've been listening to The Pocket.
All right.
Be good to yourself. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks, y'all.
Bye, guys.
Bye. We'll talk soon.